Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with journalist and author Jeff Charlotte about the latest mass murder inspired by an increasingly mainstream conspiracy theory on the right that holds that shadowy elites are replacing white people with immigrants and people of color in order to secure power. And then we're going to talk yet again about the media's wildly simplistic and potentially disastrous coverage of inflation and what's really happening in the economy. And we're going to talk about that with Lindsay Owens, who is a sociologist and also the director of the Groundwork Collaborative. But before Jeff joins us, I want to just talk a little bit about what I believe is the most destructive myth in America. It is relevant to this week's violence. It's relevant to a lot of stuff going on in this country, a lot of very bad stuff going on in this country. And you see this myth repeated everywhere. And mainstream news organizations report it as fact all the time. And I'm talking about the myth that America is becoming a, quote, minority-majority country. You often hear that this will happen by mid-century. You see news stories about how this or that state is already minority-majority. Or like they'll write a piece about how a majority of babies in Texas were, born in Texas last year, non-white, whatever the angle is, it's all the same stuff. And all of that is bullshit. I mean, all of that you read is wrong. If you go to the Census Bureau's demographic projections, you will find that America is indeed becoming more diverse. But, and this is really important, they project that whites, single race, that I should put that in quotes, whites, single race, are going to make up 70% of the U.S. population in the year 2050. And that's down from about 76% today. So a decline and potentially a, consequential decline. And there's different demographic shifts going on. We are becoming more secular, we're becoming less Christian, etc. But we're not becoming a minority-majority country. And I should say that, reporters who are writing those stories, they're not lying. Nobody's trying to deceive you about this. What's happening is that the Census Bureau projects that a minority of Americans will be white people who don't have at least one Hispanic parent or grandparent or great-grandparent in their family tree. These are non-Hispanic whites, which is interesting demographic trivia, I suppose, but we don't write news pieces about the decline of the non-Italian white population, for example. And that's true even though Southern Italians were once considered people of color, and not too long ago, in the 19th century. Now, people are very resistant to the idea that white Hispanics are in fact white people. Believe me, I've been writing about this for over a decade. And that's because in their mind's eye, when they hear Hispanic, they picture brown people. They picture indigenous people. And race and ethnicity, of course, are social constructs. So yes, there are no doubt people who self-identify as white Hispanics and would not be perceived as being white by other white people, let's say. But when you dig into the data and compare the Hispanic population as a whole with those who identify as white Hispanics, what you find is that the latter are on average more affluent, better educated, and less likely to be a first, second, or third generation immigrant than the former. As an aside, the whitest guy I've ever known, who was married to a former co-worker, an Irish lass, he checked that box. His grandfather came from Spain. Whitest dude I ever knew. Mr. Izod, preppy, total white dude. He doesn't speak a word of Spanish, right? But he checks that box. And white Hispanics, of course, see themselves as white people. They perceive themselves as belonging to the majority. Now, here I have to add that there's a really long, long history in America of light-skinned people, with light-skinned people without epicanthal folds, let's say, being widely considered to be minorities until our definition of whiteness expanded to include them. This has been something that we see over and over and over again throughout American history. You can look at the Slavs or the Black Irish, the so-called Black Irish, or Jews, or the Southern Italians I just mentioned, on and on, right? All of them were people of color at one point, according to Americans, and all are considered white now because we tend to preserve our white majority by just having a flexible definition. Of course, Black people are not allowed, and it's not that flexible, but it's flexible enough to keep expanding, and it has throughout our history. So I said earlier that this is an incredibly destructive myth, and the reason I said that is that it leads not only to the kind of violence that we saw earlier this week, but it also has been demonstrated in studies to make white people more conservative. It predicted support. The belief that America was is becoming minority majority predicted support for Donald Trump in a study. And as we will discuss with Jeff Charlotte in a minute or two, it animates the entire Republican coalition to believe that they will soon be unable to win a majority of votes. So, so much of their policy, the right-wing policy coming out of red states, is built on that belief that they cannot expect to continue to win majorities. Leads to, you know, relentless politicization of the courts because they're not a democratic branch of government. And voter suppression and gerrymandering and all of the stuff that we're constantly lamenting are animated by this belief, right? And it might ultimately lead to the end of our democratic republic. I mean, let's not mince words. So we're going to talk about that a little bit more in the context of this latest orgy of violence, white supremacist violence, in a second. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then come right back.
I won't focus on you, ooh, on God.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Jeff Charlotte. Jeff is a journalist and the author of a number of books, most recently This Brilliant Darkness, A Book of Strangers. And he wrote a piece this week for Vanity Fair about the bloodshed caused by an 18-year-old white supremacist at a Buffalo supermarket. Jeff read the murderer's racist and anti-Semitic screed and has some insights on it. Jeff, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Hi, Joshua. Good to be with you, even under these horrible circumstances.
Yes, this is a bleak, bleak story. This was at least the fourth mass killing by a person who was enraged by the so-called great replacement theory. There has been a lot of commentary to that effect. Republicans are reportedly uncomfortable with the whole topic of conversation, connecting their demagoguery to this latest act of bloodshed. But let me ask you this. Shouldn't we connect these acts of terror with a longer history of white people engaging in this kind of violence because people of color are making demands for equality? It strikes me that, you know, we're living through this backlash to the first Black president being elected, more recently to the Black Lives Matter movement. But, you know, if you look back a little further, over 2,000 Black people were lynched during the Reconstruction era following the Civil War. There have been a whole series of massacres in Tulsa and New Orleans and Rosewood and other places that many Americans don't even learn about in their history classes. Are we doing the Black community and other communities of color like a disservice by looking at these as lone wolf attacks?
We're doing every human being, including our own white selves, a disservice by looking at this as one lone wolf attack. Or maybe we just need to understand what a lone wolf attack is. It doesn't mean that it's isolated. It just means it's essentially a one-person cell. And I would say, you know, obviously these attacks go back, certainly, before Great Replacement Theory. A lot of the language with which is a 10-page section dedicated to called About the Blacks, and a lot of the pseudoscience that's coming out of that, I mean, you can find that in the 19th century. He's got a 30-page section dedicated to About the Jews. And to be clear, and I think this is actually sort of a mistake that's been going on in the media coverage, the animating antagonism for him is anti-Semitism. His understanding of Black people in another racist tradition that goes back long before Great Replacement Theory is as dupes or minions of the Jews, that the real enemies of Jews, as he says, the real war I'm trying to start here is between Gentiles and Jews. Black people will have the choice of being either killed or, you know, in his mind, going back to Africa. But Jews, there can be no peace. We have to exterminate them around the globe, because even if we put them in one place, they could infect us digitally. So that's his sort of focus. And of course, that's an old idea too. I mean, he's recycling Nazi ideas. Yes. He's recycling the protocols of the Elders of Zion, mixing it all up sort of through a lens of QAnon.
Yeah. One of the most maddening aspects of this current era is that there is always a counter narrative put out by right-wing propagandists. In this case, we have people like Glenn Greenwald, for example, are claiming that the killer was really a leftist. Now, you've waded through this guy's rant. What is your response to that?
That is the most disingenuous. Greenwald, it's just got to be disingenuous. He's not ill-informed. There are those who are ill-informed, and so they encounter this the killer calling himself a socialist and miss the part where he calls himself a national socialist, and they don't know that that's what Nazis stood for. Right. And he calls himself, I'm a neo-Nazi. Those are his words. He says, I'm a fascist. Those are his words. As for the left, he has a long section that he plagiarizes from the Christchurch Manifesto, the manifesto of the killer who in 2019 live streamed his own assault on a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand. And both of them are drawing from the manifesto of Ted Kaczynski. Now, I've seen some people on the right and stunningly on the left to assert that Kaczynski was a leftist. Kaczynski was the Unabomber. Yes. Who killed three and injured many more with his bombs in service of an idea that only a fool would call environmentalism, that was really in the white supremacist tradition of ecofascism. And the part that they quote is Kaczynski talking against leftists, and because leftists are about against everything that is good in the white, good and strong in the white male. That doesn't sound leftist to me. Yeah. I hate leftists because they're against white men. That's not really a leftist idea.
Yeah, it is. And it's frustrating to me that every time, right, every time there's this attempt to deflect blame and never any kind of introspection. In your Vanity Fair piece, you describe these manifestos as chain letters. You write that, and I quote, following every such horror, there is much discussion about the mental health of the alleged killer, but in one crucial and terrible sense, they are more deeply connected to reality than those who view them as aberrations. They believe that their crimes are rational and that they are likely to lead others to join their cause, and they're right. Jeff, can you unpack that?
Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely right in the sense that this is what happened. The Buffalo killer rights. And we should remember to take everything in such manifestos with a grain of salt. They are propaganda documents. They're trolling, they're shitposting. But nonetheless, he writes that he was despairing of the white race and was going to kill himself until he came across online a video of the Christchurch murder, and then started researching these manifestos and found a reason to live. Well, there you go. The Christchurch Manifesto begat him, as the 2011 Oslo Manifesto of Anders Breivik, an Islamophobic killer who killed nearly 100 mostly Norwegians, fellow Norwegians, whom he considered traitors. They weren't actually Muslims. He didn't target Muslims. Many of them children, a children's camp. Inspired the Christchurch killer. So each time they sort of take it a step further. And I think what's significant too is they learn from the rhetorical mistakes as well as the tactical mistakes of those that are previous. I mean, right down to clearly what the Buffalo killer did is, and he's upfront about this, he considers his manifesto a tribute to the Christchurch Manifesto. He uses it as a template, but he also corrects it. I mean, he fixes typos. He refines points, adds additional context that he thinks will make the case stronger and so on. So each one is building on the last. Right from the beginning, too, the Breivik Manifesto had pages and pages and pages of pictures of the killer and really sort of self-aggrandizing narrative. And that was used, quite understandably, to say, look, this guy is a monstrous narcissist. The Buffalo killer, two quick picks at the beginning, he says, but look, I'm irrelevant. I'm just a simple white guy. And he understands that this is going to have more power as a meme if he makes himself, in his mind, a kind of everyman, a template, just like the manifesto, into which the next killer in the line can slot himself.
You know, it's striking to me that these people have their deadly views validated every day now by ostensibly mainstream sources. I mean, this kid may have been radicalized on 4chan or 8chan or whatever dark corner of the internet, but the so-called great replacement theory has become a mainstream on the right. I mean, obviously Fox News has been pushing it, but so too do Republican elected officials. It may have been fringe at one point, but that is not the case at present. What is stochastic terrorism, and why do you think people like Tucker Carlson or Elise Stefanik, the number three ranking Republican in the House, are so unconcerned about the consequences of this demagoguery, of this replacement rhetoric? Or is the threat of violence part of the right's kind of larger effort to, I don't know, intimidate us into accepting minority rule?
I mean, as to the individual psyches of Tucker Carlson and Elise Stefanik, I can't speak. But yeah, on the larger sense, I think unconcerned is the wrong word. Seeking yeah. This. And that's why I opened the piece with the fact that that very night, the night of the killing, this doesn't precede it. The killer is not acting on these words. But that very night, the sort of ancient and decrepit former rock star Ted Nugent, since become kind of a fascist provocateur, opened for Donald Trump in Austin, Texas. And he says to the crowd, he says, I love you people madly, but I'd love you more if you went forward and just went berserk on the skulls of the Democrats and the Marxists and the communists. So this is what he says to a large crowd. He says, I'd love you more if you just went berserk on the skulls of the Democrats and the Marxists and the communists. I'd argue that's stochastic terrorism. That's language that is meant to incite violence. It's not figurative. It's not elusive. It's not insinuating. It's saying you would be a better person if you attacked our enemies and if you attack them physically. Went berserk on the skulls. There is no figure of speech. Sometimes they try and say, yeah, we just mean fight in the political sense. Nobody right. says berserk on the skulls. In the figurative sense. So yeah, they're seeking violence, but also the distance from it that allows them a certain amount of deniability, but a wink. They don't want that much distance from it. They want the threat. And again, I mean, that's why I think it's a mistake to call these men lone wolves. Look, the next killer to come down the line, and they will emulate the Buffalo Killer, is going to draw just as he did on not just the ideas, but in the instruction manuals of the previous manifestos. His is the most advanced, 96 pages dedicated to every single piece of equipment he used, and then a sort of Consumer Report style analysis. Here are all the different brands. Here's where you can buy them. Here's how much it should cost. Here are sellers that are good to work with. Here are ones that's not. Here are the pros and cons. And all along saying, look, I used kind of not such great equipment. This is to show you, this is what you can do with even just sort of solid equipment. And if you want to go higher end, here's how to do it. They're going to do that. That's not a lone wolf. And someone's going to go berserk on the skulls of Democrats, Marxists, and communists, by which they mean anyone who is not subscribed to the fascist ideology.
Yeah. I just want to add some new reporting out this week. Dana Milbank talked about this in the Washington Post. There was a study put together by the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. We've had the director of that outfit on the show in the past. They found that 22% of all elected Republican lawmakers had participated are participating members of extremist Facebook groups. So, you know, there is this increasingly fuzzy line between mainstream right and, you know, the again, what was once considered the fringe. And I think it's important to pull back a bit and put this latest outburst of violence into a larger context, because, you know, there's no moral equivalent between killing people and passing laws restricting the vote or stealing Supreme Court seats, but it's all motivated by the belief that white people, and especially white Christians, are becoming a minority. And this animates an enormous amount of policymaking on the right. Are we doing enough to get that message out?
Oh, of course not. We are inching. The Civil War clock is inching toward midnight, you know. We're really not. I mean, as long as we're using euphemistic terms like election denier, they're not election deniers. That sounds like someone who's confused or maybe deluded. They're coup plotters.
Yes.
Probably some people have seen this. The current GOP nominee or front runner for governor in Pennsylvania, Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin are all people who not only encouraged the coup in 2020, but make part of their platform that they will not respect an election in 2024. That's a coup, right? So we need to use the plain language. We've gotten much better. The fact, of course, the press, the mainstream uses the term white supremacist, which 5 years ago would have been impossible. The fact that we're using the term fascism, which I mean, in the past, I've been mistaken. Years ago, I wrote a book called The Family. And which I was writing about a post-World War II era. And I said the F word in American history is fascism. And the reality is that full force fascism will never come to America. And now I understand people say, well, what about this? Isn't Tulsa fascism? Yes. But a full fascist regime? No. And I said, I thought that it wouldn't, because I thought that, in fact, Christian fundamentalism would. There's more than one kind of bad under the sun. I was wrong. Fascism and the full ideological sense is here, and we're talking about it. We need to talk about it more. We need to resist all the kind of euphemistic speaking. So I couldn't help but notice you called it a screed at the beginning. I noticed NPR announced that they would not call it a manifesto because they didn't want to give these ideas the respect of taking them seriously. And that's a dangerous conflation. I don't respect these ideas at all, but I take them deadly seriously. Yeah. It is a manifesto. Let's not hide from it. It's a manifesto. It's going to function like a manifesto. Manifesto is not a particularly positive word.
No.
It's there. And even in this sense, I think it makes sense, for instance, to not use the names of sort of more random mass killers. But none of us say, I won't say the name Eichmann, I won't say the name Himmler. These are part of a movement and we should recognize them. And then when we say the name Peyton Gendron, we understand that we are putting him in dialogue with that other name we'll say, which is Tucker Carlson. These right. people are in conversation together.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff, Charlotte, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Joshua. I really enjoyed talking with you, even on a terrible subject.
Yeah. Folks, check out Jeff's piece. It's titled The Terrifying Familiarity of the Buffalo Shooting Suspect's Extremist Screed. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back. Welcome back. I'm very happy to be joined by Lindsay Owens. Lindsay is the executive director of the Groundwork Collaborative. Lindsay, new inflation data is out this week. It painted a pretty ugly picture over the past year. Wages are up by 5.5%, but when you account for higher costs, real wages fell by over 2%. Your former boss, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, she blamed corporate price gouging, and it seems like this infuriated a lot of economists who basically scoffed at the notion. I think it was Paul Krugman who tweeted that while he agreed that price gouging alone wasn't enough to explain this inflationary this current wave of inflation, it's a factor. And he said that their reactions were just completely ridiculous and overblown. What do you make of that?
Oh man, you know, par for the course. Senator Elizabeth Warren enters the fray, and the sort of neoliberal want class has a, you know, collective panic attack. You know, on the editorial pages, right? The Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal just, you know, couldn't contain themselves over the weekend. Summers sort of compared it to like Trump, you know, suggesting that bleach cures COVID. I mean, just really over the top, vitriolic, snide, you know, derisive sort of language here. You know, the right people are angry. She's on to something. She's always on to something. She was on to something about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She was on to something about the wealth tax. And she's on to something about price gouging and inflation. Look, the data's in on this. You know, prices are up. Families are being squeezed. And yet those rising prices are not eating into corporate profit margins. Corporate right. profit margins are soaring. What explains that is quite simple. And the CEOs are telling us in broad daylight. What explains it? They're passing on their rising costs. So they break even. And then they're going for more, you know, and they're going for a lot more. And that's the price gouging that Senator Warren is talking about, is the price gouging that my team at the Groundwork Collaborative has been, you know, sounding the alarm on since August, when we started digging into these earnings calls that CEOs have with shareholders. And, you know, we were just reporting out what CEOs were telling their investors. They were saying, hey, look at this. We're bringing in big profits right now because we're passing along price increases that we haven't really taken in years.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that they are very open about this. And then you have this kind of pundit class just gaslighting everybody that this is a preposterous thing to even imagine. I should mention that The Guardian, they did an analysis of 100 large corporations' financial statements and earnings calls. And they found that, and I quote, most are enjoying profit increases even as they pass on cost to consumers. The analysis found net profits up by a median of 49%, and in one case by as much as 111,000%. And the Guardian goes on to say that those increases came as companies saddled customers with higher prices, and all but 10 executed massive stock buyback programs or bumped dividends to enrich investors. And then, as you mentioned, in earnings calls, executives detailed how even as demand and profits rose post-vaccine, they passed on most or all inflationary costs to consumers, customers, and then some took the opportunity to add more on top. That story was published, I should mention, at the end of April. Republicans in Congress took a brief break from complaining about high gas prices this week to first block a bill in committee, and then over 200 of them voted against it. That bars oil companies from price gouging at the pump. So they're really capitalizing on this issue. Lindsay, what is the administration doing to try to get prices under control? And what more should they be doing, if anything?
Yeah, so the administration is doing a handful of things on the inflation front. The first, obviously, is they're kind of standing out of the way and letting the Federal Reserve take action through interest rate hikes. Obviously, interest rate hikes, a really blunt tool for cooling inflation, sort of operates through making us all a little poorer. It operates through the demand side, and it doesn't fix any of these supply side issues that we face. It doesn't fix the war in the Ukraine. It doesn't fix, you know, China's COVID policies, which are resulting in delays in shipping. It doesn't fix the other supply chain snarls that we're facing right now, including you know, ones in the United States, like with Abbott, the baby formula manufacturer. But the president is working on a number of fronts. So they have spent a lot of time trying to, you know, sort of get the gum out of the works in the supply chain and try to increase capacity for delivery across the United States, across a number of transportation mechanisms. They have also, you know, the president has also directed the Department of Justice, the Federal Maritime Commission, Federal Trade Commission, Department of Agriculture, you know, all of the agencies who have a role to play in regulating, you know, egregious sort of pricing behavior to take a look at it and to make moves as they see fit. So he asked the Federal Trade Commission to look into oil and gas price gouging and to look into some of the major retailers who are bringing prices up. He asked, you know, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Justice to work together to take a look at the four big meat packing processors who really have, you know, up to 85% of the market, depending on the type of meat. And, you know, and the result is sky high food process prices, high profits for the big four meat packers, and very little for the ranchers. So I think, you know, they're doing what they can. But, you know, he has a relatively limited tool set here. And so he's going to need Congress to move as well.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned, you know, these big structural issues that are causing this. It's kind of mind-boggling the way that the coverage of inflation kind of ignores the fact that so much of it is the result of this massive disruption caused by the pandemic. You know, typically the cost of some goods rise while others fall. And we're seeing rising costs almost across the board because of a combination of factors that are resulting from the pandemic. CNBC actually had an interesting story about the relationship between Americans relocating and these inflationary hotspots popping up. And the gist of it was that a lot of people have moved in the past couple of years for various reasons, including being able to work remotely and, you know, many of them move from more expensive coastal cities to cheaper places inland, like Phoenix, Arizona, or Atlanta, Georgia, both of which were mentioned in the story. And that in turn causes a spike in demand for everything in those new cities that all these people have, you know, that have seen this influx of people from housing to food and really everything else. And I live in one of the kind of hottest real estate markets in the country, in Kingston, New York, in upstate New York. And we have experienced this in a big way. Prices are all shooting up because half of the people of Brooklyn have moved up here in the last couple of years. It's really mind-boggling how how broad the ripple effects from the pandemic are. And that's before we even talk about the Ukraine war and issues that you mentioned in China, et cetera. FAIR did a study of media coverage of inflation. They looked at 6 months of network and cable news reporting, and they found that profits were mentioned as a causal factor less than any other factor, less than worker shortages, supply chain issues, social spend. Every other factor was featured more prominently than just price gouging. What are your thoughts about the way the media have covered this issue?
Yeah, I think the media have really missed a big piece of the inflation story. Look, the Economic Policy Institute a few weeks ago released a new study, new analysis, showing that, you know, there are three components that make up these price increases. If you look at the price increases we've seen since the sort of second quarter of 2020 when the pandemic started to now, you've got labor costs and the contribution of potentially rising labor costs. You've got non-labor input costs. So you've got things like the cost of raw materials that you use to make the stuff and their rise and increase. And then you've got what we call the markup, which is the gravy, right? The piece you add above your costs to bring in the profit. And what they found at the Economic Policy Institute was really just stunning, which is that 54% of the explanation for the increase and rise in prices since the second quarter of 2020 is coming from the markup. The majority of the increase is coming from corporations juicing prices just for pure profit. That is a stunning reversal of the status quo, where usually labor costs and input costs are contributing a much higher percentage of price increases. So just a complete reversal. Labor costs are only accounting for 8% of the increase in prices over that period. So profits are such a critical part of the story. Profiteering and price gouging are a critical part of the story. And yeah, the media has got to take a look at it. You know, we're doing everything we can to make sure that it's driving the coverage and you know, have had some success, but we've got to see more.
Yeah, that's a remarkable statistic. It really is. And, you know, they're doing it because they can get away with it, and they know that they're not going to face the blame for it, right? I mean, that's really the bottom line. My big gripe with the coverage is that this is a global phenomenon. And if you don't offer that context prominently, I have to wonder, you know, what you're doing. Why would you report on inflation as if it's an American problem when it clearly is not? UK's inflation numbers just came out this week also, and they're at 9%.
Right. Higher. So,
I mean, you know, we're at 8%, and that's not good, but they're at 9%. So,
well, and the UK number you mentioned, I think, is so important. You raised such an important point because, you know, there are a number of sort of folks in the technocratic economist class who are trying to blame, you know, inflation on the American Rescue Plan. And of course, you know, there was no American Rescue Plan in the United Kingdom. And so, I mean, it's just so clear that the evidence doesn't support a story that, you know, $1,400 checks for Americans caused, you know, 8%+ inflation. It's just, you know, it doesn't pass the smell test. It doesn't pass the empirical test. And yet, you know, folks like Larry Summers and others who really have a vested interest in making President Biden's Recovery Act look problematic, in part because, you know, they're sort of trying to launder their own reputations here, right? Like Larry Summers, widely understood to be the architect of the jobless recovery in the Great Recession. You know, yeah. He's sort of trying to make this recovery look not so good and saying, oh, it's because they did too much. You said I didn't do enough, but this is what too much looks like. But there's really no evidence that the ARP, the American Rescue Plan, contributed to, you know, in any meaningful way to the inflation numbers we're seeing. And that UK data is sort of the like smoking gun.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not just the UK. You see it in Japan. Japan has massive inflationary issues across the EU.
Eurozone inflation is high.
A global phenomenon. It is just a global phenomenon. Lindsay Owen, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it. I believe we're out of time, though.
Thanks for having me.
I'd also like to thank Jeff Charlotte and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. दूर है गुरुशिदार दूर के मेरे दोस्त कैसे क्या भूल गए सुनते छोटे बच्चे में स्कूल के जनरेशन हाथ में कैसे भूल गए काटे थे गुलाब के फूल पे गाने लेकर नींद में से उठ गए रैप करने वाले सब छूट गए रैप करने वाले सब रुक गए लड़की के लिए घर टूट गए मंजिल का रास्ता नहीं पूछते घर था मैं अपना मैं गए लिखा मैंने इतना की खत्म वहाँ पे सब या फिर आज नबी दे घर माँ तो या फिर आज लियत में जिसने मेरा फील करा पेन फेमस होने के लिए मेरा यूज करने ये बज गाने बज रहे सेम दूसरे की बला दुकान दे पहले चले लग जाते मेरे शूज में